Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln. It's better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt. Well, flying in the face of that, we have 3 hours coming up here. I'll let you make up your own mind. Coming up on today's program, Ali Ansari will be here on the failure of American foreign policy and the next great conflict in the Middle East. Right now, Yaron Brook is with us. He's the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the organization that carries the torch of Ayn Rand. And Yaron, I see this op-ed piece over on your website, What to Learn from Ken Lay. Was Ken Lay a corporate sinner or a corporate saint?
Oh, he's a corporate sinner, no question. He was a short-term, pragmatic, non-thinking, schmoozing political CEO. He was not the kind of businessman that I would admire at all.
Well, now, Alex Epstein, here's from the piece. It says, former Enron chairman Ken Lay has just died. The common perception of Lay is that he and other Enron leaders, eager to make money, scheme to bilk investors. Mm-hmm. The ethical question, it is said, is that we must teach or force businessmen to curb their selfish profit-seeking impulses before they turn criminal. Alex Epstein says, but all this is wrong.
That's right. I mean, I don't think Ken Lay was selfish. I think Ken Lay was stupid. He was short-sighted. He was non-thinking. And he was much more focused on attending Bush parties with its senior or junior than he was running the business. And as a consequence, he let fraud happen under his nose. He let Andy Fastow commit obvious fraud. But I don't think Ken Lay sat there and schemed to bilk investors of millions of dollars. Indeed, he didn't sell enough stock to give us any evidence of that. What he did was violate his fiduciary duty to shareholders as the CEO in taking his eyes off the ball and making really bad and stupid decisions.
What this really brings us back to, I think, Yaron, is the question of to what extent do we rely on your belief that if capitalists are absolutely unregulated, capitalists and or business people who may or may not be, actually, you could argue that Ken Lay was not a capitalist, he was a businessman, at least in the early days, are to behave in a totally unregulated fashion, that ultimately, with the exception of the single regulation being that of fraud, that ultimately social good will come from that, versus what I think is the consensus among Americans and certainly among Europeans, that business is simply a game that can be played, and that the rules of the game should define certain boundaries that include some consideration for the public good.
But what is interesting here is that almost all the fraud that happened in 2000, you know, whether it's WorldCom and Enron and a bunch of others, all happened in heavily, heavily regulated industries. Indeed, the industries that are less regulated, you didn't see much fraud.
Well,
but the real fraud... These are all telecom businesses. These are all electric utility industries that are heavily regulated, in which CEOs rise to the top because they can manipulate politicians, not because they are good businessmen. That is, good at providing demand, you know, creating stuff that consumers then buy. So
how
they are manipulators.
You're on, Brooke.
So I would argue that if you deregulated these industries, truly deregulated, I mean really gotten government out of it completely and left it to market mechanisms, you would see dramatically less fraud, not more.
No, you'd see one company ending up owning the whole thing.
No, that's nonsense.
The fact of the matter is that in 1996, Bill Clinton, for all practical purposes, deregulated the telecom industry, and the deregulation of the energy industry was what made Enron possible.
But that's just not true. If you look at the deregulation bill that came out of 1996, it is bigger in terms of number of pages and number of regulations and number of things that the companies needed to do than the previous regulation. I mean, that's just a fact.
But I would argue that most of those were
pages. And the reason is that it's not deregulation, it's what I call re-regulation. It's changing the rules. It's exactly what you like. That is what they
do. No, it's changing the rules in the ways that the companies wanted them changed.
No, well, so what? But they didn't change them in a way that actually frees up the market. What they did was change the rules of the game to benefit some parties at the expense of others. I'm against that. I'm for doing away with those rules, other than fraud, leaving businesses alone. The same with the California electric market. It wasn't deregulated. It was re-regulated. The rules were changed to benefit some parties at the expense of other parties.
And as a consequence,
you get fraud. You get fraud when these rules are changed, and everybody's running around as if they're like chickens with their heads
cut off. So let's just play this thing out.
What the new rules are.
Let's just play this thing out, Aaron. You have, in the California energy market, for example, you have... You know, a whole bunch of different... You still there?
We have a funky phone connection here. We do, yeah.
You have a whole bunch of different energy companies providing electricity. And you completely deregulate the industry.
That's not true.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
It hasn't happened.
Yep.
I'm saying hypothetically, I'd like to play this thing out. What's going to be the logical conclusion of this? You say, okay, no regulations anymore. Anybody can charge anything they want. They can do anything to anybody. They can do it however they want.
Yep.
And so the company that has access to the greatest amount of cash will start buying up other companies until you end up with one company left that's running the entire energy industry in California. And then that one company will say to folks like you and me, I don't think either one of us live in California, but to the residents of California, will say to them, okay, here's the price you have to pay now. Because energy is a natural monopoly. Yeah, sure.
But that's just nonsense. And there are no examples of this in history. And indeed, it doesn't make any economic sense. And any economist with 2 cents would tell you that that would not happen because there are diseconomies of scale. There are diseconomies. You become less efficient. Because you grow too much, there are opportunities for smaller competitors to come in and steal market share from you.
Not if you own the wires.
Monopolies don't exist in true free markets. This happens time and time again. There's no example in history, no example in the entire history of the United States, even when it was closer to capitalism in the 19th century, of a company owning an enormous amount and as a consequence raising prices and lowering quality. Not Standard Oil, when it owned 98% of the oil. Prices went down and quality went up every single year. Not Alcoa, when it owned 85% of aluminum, prices went down, quality went up every year. There are no examples of this yet. You know, people spout this nonsense all the time, but it's just not true. It doesn't happen that way. Capitalism does not.
Number one, those were not examples of laissez-faire markets. Number two,
as laissez-faire as it gets.
John Rockefeller, you go back.
John Rockefeller not only saved the whale.
You can let me finish one sentence here, Yarn. You go back and read the history of John Rockefeller. I mean, he bragged about the fact that he would conspire with the railroads to
he didn't conspire.
Block.
He paid the railroads more money to take his goods because
he paid them not to carry other people's goods.
Because he got priority because he was delivering.
No, it wasn't a matter of priority. He would pay the railroads to refuse to carry the goods of other people.
And that's what made
there were hearings before Congress on this, Yarn.
What's that?
There were hearings before Congress on this in the 1880s.
Unfortunately, Congress started to get involved even back then in the economy. But the problem is that.
So back to the electric company. Give me an example.
Hang on just a second.
Yes, exactly. Let's go back to that.
Ukraine prices would go up. And John D. Rockefeller, go back to the empirical evidence. John D. Rockefeller, every single year, prices went down.
There is one set of electric wires coming into my house. There's one set of electric wires coming into your house. There's one set of electric wires coming into my house. There's one set of high tension lines that feed our neighborhood. How can any company compete with the company that owns those wires?
Well, they could put wires into the ground together with the cable. There are lots of ways in which they could compete if we let them. Of course, you're not going to find the solutions to competitions if you restrict competition. There is no competition today in electricity because we don't allow it.
No, because it's a natural monopoly.
And there's a monopoly in electricity that is protected by government. You're not allowed to compete with
electricity. No, we are protected by government.
We're not protected by government. Indeed, we pay much higher electricity costs today than we would under laissez-faire. So what's being protected today are the utility companies.
Under laissez-faire, we would be the serfs to the barons of the robber barons of the electric industry.
No, and I wish, because I think the robber
because
barons
there's nothing to protect us.
Great, the robber barons are heroes. I mean, I think it's a travesty to
you
call
had most of America living in poverty when the robber barons.
The Carnegies and the Rockefellers and those people created every major industry that we benefit from today. They
no, the laborers who were paying with their sweat and their blood were the ones who created it. Carnegie was the guy who simply organized it.
Those people with the sweat and blood would have been dying in their farms if not for the Carnegies and the Rockefellers who created those jobs for them.
Okay, Yaron Brook, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the website. Thanks for being with us, Yaron.
My pleasure.
Always a gas talking with you.
Yeah.
No pun intended. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And wrong was a whiz bang on the dial. Almost as big as Jesus. The how catch your name. And they put it on the baseball park downtown. Enron took my money. We lost it all, they say. With questionable accounting, I'm gutted. My 401k.
Yes. Welcome back. 22 minutes. Enron took my money. Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our program. 907 days, 12 hours, 37 minutes, 23 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office and the long national nightmare ends. Assuming that there's no impeachment, which might actually speed the process up. Isn't it fascinating how the Republicans have stopped talking about how the Democrats want to impeach Bush? Why? Because what they discovered is that even Republicans want Bush impeached. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Well, our discussion with Yaron Brook at the Ayn Rand Institute, again, just you know, highlights this religion of the conservatives I'm not even sure conservatives is the right word, of those who believe that laissez-faire capitalism will solve all problems. And I'm sorry, it doesn't. In fact, when you look at an economy with laissez-faire capitalism being the dominant form of governance, first of all, it's not democratic because capitalism is not democracy. Capitalism is kingdoms. Businesses are kingdoms. They're the last remnant of kingdoms that we have in our society are businesses. They're totally not democratic. And secondly, what you find is that you do not have a middle class. If you look at Dickens' England that he wrote about in A Christmas Carol, Scrooge and Marley, and Bob Cratchit, for example, or in virtually all of Charles Dickens' novels, because his father was thrown into a debtor's prison. I mean, Charles Dickens knew the consequence of laissez-faire capitalism. What you find is that you have a large class of the working poor, and you have a small class of the wealthy capitalist elite. And that's it. And yes, those who advocate for it are right when they say it does provide for a relatively stable society. Feudalism, which is what laissez-faire capitalism is, in my opinion, feudalism was a very stable form of government. I mean, feudal China, 2,000 years, feudal Japan, 2,000 years, feudal Europe, a couple thousand years. The Aztec civilization was, by and large, a feudal civilization. Rule by the rich is a stable form of government. But is it the right form of government? Is it the best form of government? Does it work for we the people? No, in my opinion. And is it consistent with democracy? Absolutely not. It is the enemy of democracy. Kurt in Idabel, Oklahoma. Hey, Kurt, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. Kurt? He's up. Kurt, if you can hear me, I can't hear you, so I'm going to put you on hold, and we will go to the next call. John in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, John.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I bet you will. I like that little adding the seconds to when Bush is gone. It really makes me feel good.
Yeah, we're down to now 12 hours, 34 minutes, and 38 seconds.
What really makes me mad is these people claiming that in any way, shape, or form, they represent the ideas that Ayn Rand brought forth and gave birth to. I mean, the people she was talking about were originators. They were creative individuals who did something new. These people are just sock puppets for money, you know?
Yeah. Although, you know, John Galt invented that machine while he was working for the railroad. So
yeah.
Under today's laws, the railroad actually owned the machine, which means that her entire novel couldn't have happened.
John Galt quit working for the railroad because of exactly what they were pulling, which these people are puppets for the government, and the government's puppets for them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about one hand washing the other. The only problem is we get all the dirt.
Yeah, there you go.
They get the soap and water, we get the dirt. And
yep.
This was nothing what her books were about.
Yeah.
And when I hear these people talking, did they ever read them?
Well, they actually did. And in fact, Andrew Bernstein, who we often have on from Ayn Rand Institute, wrote the Cliff Notes version of Atlas Shrugged, which, you know, is studied by school kids all over America all the time. The point is that Ayn Rand, you know, she grew up in Soviet Russia.
Yes, I'm aware.
During the Bolshevik Revolution, her father lost his pharmacy to the revolution. She studied political science at the University of Kiev, and she made the mistake when she came to the United States of believing that there were two political systems, communism and capitalism, and she never understood democracy. She never understood the concept of the commons. You won't find it in her books. And that's the fatal flaw in Ayn Rand's philosophy. She, you know, the idea of looking for objective truths, the idea of, you know, the individual, all those noble ideas. But the idea of the commons and the public good is absent from her writing.
Well, this is true, and the simple fact is, if people were perfect, any political system would work, but we're not. And her books are great in what they bring out and what they say about people. I do agree with you that, yes, she didn't see that part of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little overstressed, but these people just have no clue what they're talking about.
Okay. Well, John, thanks for weighing in.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call, and thanks for listening to us. I'm assuming on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're calling from a truck in Tulsa. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
I care not for the polar bear. I hate the caribou. I love the sound of gushing wells and black gold bubbling through. Halibut, calamari, halibut, calamari. I love that happy song.
Yes, the Halliburton Oil Song. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. And pleased to be with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, their telephone number. And give them a call and tell them I said hi. Wendy Graham, the top commodities regulator in the Bush administration and wife of Senator Phil Graham, by the way, the Republican from Texas. She was the top commodities regulator in the first Bush administration and invited to serve on Enron's board in 1993. She accepted a seat on the board 5 weeks after she pushed through a ruling at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission that would exempt Enron from regulation. This was back in 1993. This was under Bush Sr. This is where it all started, exempting Enron from regulation. United States Trade Representative Robert B. Zoellick served on the Advisory Council of Enron Corporation. His income included $50,000 in advisory fees from Enron. Political advisor Karl Rove owned as much as $250,000 in Enron stock. He also reported investments in BP, Amoco, and Royal Dutch Shell. He also took part in meetings to shape energy policy while he still owned energy company stocks. Lawrence Lindsay, President Bush's chief economic advisor, received $50,000 last year from Enron for consulting. In 1999, it would have been the year before last now, in 1999 and 2000, Lindsay attended meetings of Enron's economic advisory board. He later incorporated some of the ideas from those meetings into the George W. Bush campaign's energy policy. Besides that connection, his consulting firm had, among its clients, Enron! Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, Charlotte L. Beers, holdings of more than $100,000 in Enron. Governor George W. Bush made a telephone call in October of 1997 on behalf of Ken Lay to Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge to help Enron gain entry into the energy market in Pennsylvania. The minority staff of the Committee on Government Reform reported at least 17 policies of the White House energy plan were supported or written by Enron or benefited and or benefited the company financially. And it just goes on and on and on. I mean, you want page after page after page of this stuff, go check out EnronWatchdog.org. 1-866-440-8466. We're discussing the foibles and follies and in some cases, good sides of capitalism, the foibles and follies of laissez-faire capitalism, more specifically. Kurt in Idabel, Oklahoma. Hey, Kurt.
Hey, Tom. Good to speak to you.
Thanks for calling. What's up?
You know, real quick, doesn't that kind of prove the point that regulation doesn't work and that it favors the rich when you have things like that happening with Enron after the re-regulation?
Well, it depends on how you define regulation. For example, when Bush Sr. was vice president, Monsanto went to him, and they said, we need regulations for these new things called genetically modified organisms. They didn't exist at the time. But they wanted regulations for them. This is the industry asking for regulation. And Bush actually put together a task force and pushed this through as vice president. Why did they want it? Because they wanted to legalize it. You know, once something is regulated, it's legalized. Similarly, the mining companies have argued for regulations of arsenic. They want arsenic to be regulated at 10 parts per million, or maybe it's per billion, in water supplies, that you can't have over 10 parts per million. Why? Well, because 7, 8, 9 parts per million will cause cancer, but now because it's regulated, you can't sue them. And so there's a lot of industries that want regulation because it actually works to their benefit. In fact, I would suggest, and in this regard, I'm probably in agreement with Yaron, that probably 70-80% of all regulations on the books are actually have been weaseled around enough that they benefit monopolies and they benefit companies. On the other hand, there are natural monopolies. Yaron doesn't convince me that I can have five electric companies vying for my business because five of them are going to build wires over to my house. I mean,
That kind of goes to my original point that I wanted to make. You know, especially with natural resource companies, electrical one being, deregulation may allow for the new technologies that we're pushing so hard for, like solar, like wind, and I think, you know, and that's not something that can happen overnight, but when you allow the markets, and I'm by no means an economist, but when you allow the markets to determine what people want, I think, you know, generally people want an alternative form of energy.
Actually, it works the other way around, because the alternative form of energy in its early stages costs more.
Sure,
And so what happens is that the energy companies, because they're unregulated, to the extent that they are unregulated, you know, capitalist entities, as it were, their goal is to maximize profit on a quarterly and annual basis so that their stockholders get the largest dividend and so that their CEOs get the biggest bonuses. And so they're not going to move in the direction of alternative energy unless they're given incentives to do that. It is, however, a strong argument for the kind of electricity that is provided to about half of America, which is community-owned electricity. In many of the communities in America where there are strong movements towards alternative energy, it's because the local utilities are not owned by a corporate board of directors and by stockholders, but they're owned by the citizens of the community themselves. And the citizens of the community themselves get together and say, you know, we're willing to pay an extra 10% for our electricity if that money is going to go to build a windmill farm or to put solar cells on the roofs of everybody's house. We're not willing to spend an extra 10% on electricity if it means that the CEO's salary goes from $300 million a year to $500 million a year.
Well, one thing, you know, before we get off the phone, one other thing is I'd like to, you know, I was raised a Reagan Republican up north, and I'm by no means Republican or Democrat at this point. And I think we get caught up in these left-right kind of paradigms where, you know, people have identified themselves one way or the other. And, you know, the more you talk to people, I think generally people agree on most things 70% of 80% of the time. And, you know, you talked about how in a democracy, you know, well, we're not a democracy, we're a republic, and I think a lot of people lose
sight
of
that. We're actually both, Kurt.
Yeah, and understandable, but I think we lose sight of the republic part of it more. And, you know, the
well, what is the how is a republic different from a democracy in your mind, Kurt?
In my mind, when you talk about a republic, you think of a confederated a group of states, and that they're, to some extent, regulated by the federal government, but not run by the federal government.
And you know, how is a democracy different than that?
Democracy is, this concept of democracy we're in now is this idea that people rule the country, and that's, you know, individuals, citizens, and we're not at that state. I mean, right now you look at the people who run, you know, our government, and they're...
Don't you think that's what most Americans want, though, is that democracy? See, I mean, if you want to get technical, we live in a constitutionally limited democratic republic. Actually, it's a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. And the main reason why you will hear right-wingers make the talking point that we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic, is because back when Newt Gingrich was doing his Contract on America and Frank Luntz first started doing his in-depth psychological analysis, they discovered that the word democracy sounds too much like democratic, like the Democratic Party. And so two things came out of that. One was never refer to America as a democracy again because it sounds like Democratic Party. And number two, don't refer to the Democratic Party by its real name, the Democratic Party. Start referring to it as the Democrat Party. There is no such thing as the Democrat Party. But Republicans are very, very careful about that. They refer to this as the Republic because it sounds like a Republican. And they refer to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party. And they try to emphasize the second syllable, which is the word rat. And this was just, you know, psychological warfare. Go back and read. There's a marvelous book called How Democratic is the American Constitution, or is the U.S. Constitution, by Ronald Dahl. He's a college professor. He's not a he's no politics in it at all. It's all about James Madison, basically, in the first, you know, 20 years of this country as the Constitution was written and afterwards. Before 1787, before Madison and Hamilton, who ended up being on political opposites, but at the time they were working together to get the Constitution passed, before 1787, when they started writing the Federalist Papers, the words democracy and republic were absolutely interchangeable in our dictionary and British dictionaries right across the world. They were just interchangeable. Madison had to figure out a way to sell the Constitution. And so in Federalist number 10, you will find he splits these words apart for the first time, didn't even conform with the dictionary. And he said essentially, democracy is mob rule, where, you know, one man, one vote, and mob rule is not a good thing. We have to have a rule of law, and a republic is an infrastructure of rule of law within which you have representatives who are elected in a democratic fashion. And America is going to be a republic, not a democracy. And that was the selling point of the Constitution. But 20 years later, when Madison was president, he came back and he said, you know, very candidly, and Dahl has this in his letters from Madison, he says, you know, that was basically just a sales job. And, in fact, the United States is a democracy.
Mm. Well, you know, these Republicans, especially, there's nothing there. What we're moving towards with this group is more of a fascist government.
Yeah, they're not interested in democracy or republic.
Right, by any stretch of
the. And there's a few Democrats, by the way, in that category as well.
Yeah, I would put 40-50% of the Democrats. I mean, anybody with any amount of money that's going to, you know, essentially make money off the backs of, you know, Joe Sixpack.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably more like about 20% of the Democrats, those who are really deeply in bed with the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC.
I hope you're right, because if we see a change, I hope we see a real change, because it's been a long time since I've seen a real change, and I'm not that old.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think the Democratic Party is starting to wake up. David Sirota just did a piece on this a couple days ago about how they're starting to wake up about the so-called free trade. You know, Americans are figuring out that they've been had, and it's a bipartisan, but they've been had. But the Democratic Party is waking up fast, and maybe the Republican Party will too.
If the Democrats can get that conservative edge, there's an opportunity there.
There really is. Kurt, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you,
I appreciate it, and thanks for listening to the program. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The only thing that changes in my mind, I never cut toe the mark, and I never could walk the line.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a little democracy, maybe a few clean elections. We'd settle for that. Really, we would. Because we know what the outcome would be. It would be, you know, a finer, better country, right? Just a reminder, Monday night, I'll be doing a fundraiser for Jim McDermott, well, along with Bill Clinton. I'll be emceeing the gig, actually. Bill Clinton and Jim McDermott will be doing the fundraiser, and I'll be the MC. There will also be a band there, a local jazz band. And it's you can get tickets and more information about it at McDermott, MC, Dermott, D-E-R-M-O-T-T, 4-F-O-R, congress.com, or you can call 206-903-0148, 206-903-0148 if you want to support a good progressive congressman who is just had the right wing on his butt for 9.5 years now. John Boehner, whatever, has been suing this guy because he outed Newt Gingrich. And this lawsuit has cost Jim McDermott $400,000 so far to defend himself. And so we're trying to help him clean some of that up. I mean, this is just outrageous. This the punishment by the Republicans, the political payback, it's just bad. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just want to talk about this laissez-faire or unfettered capitalism issue. I just have a couple of comments. I'm no economist or anything, but any freshman college student who has taken an economics class will tell you about the principle of opportunity cost.
Right.
There is an opportunity cost attached to everything. So while if there was no regulations, or I'd prefer to call them rules, if there were no rules, sure, prices might come down, but there's a cost for that. And I believe that cost would be in damage to our air, damage to our water, risk for workers, things like that. I would prefer to pay a little bit more for the electricity to ensure that our air quality and water quality is good and that the people that are providing us with the service are actually safe.
I agree. The other problem with a laissez-faire system where everything is reactive rather than proactive is, for example, I would suggest that, you know, John Stossel, a libertarian of his stripe, would reply to you, well, if people don't like the fact that the power plant is spewing out emissions in their face, they'll simply get together and say, we're not going to buy electricity from them. Well,
impossible.
First of all,
that's absurd. That's living in the la-la land.
You can
do that with widgets. Or cat food or something like that, but you can't do it with electricity.
Yeah, exactly.
And real quick, my other comment, what really perked my ears up here is when the guy mentioned Carnegie, okay?
Yeah.
I come from Pittsburgh. To me, it's the cradle of the labor movement. If it wasn't for the labor movement, which Carnegie and Frick and all those guys tried their damnedest to try to squash, we would not have a middle class here in Pittsburgh.
Yep.
All my neighbors and myself, we are a product of that labor movement. And, of course, and Carnegie's, you know, industry. But I'd also like to point out about Carnegie that he's not necessarily the greatest guy around that everybody likes to make him out to be because he's some philanthropist, you know, in his old age before he was dying. Him, Frick, and a bunch of the other robber barons are responsible for the deaths of over 3,000 people in Johnstown, PA, because they were too cheap to actually build the dam correctly, to check the dam correctly, and
for the Johnstown flood you're talking about.
Exactly. I mean, there's 3,000 people, which is bad enough. It wiped out the whole town.
Yep.
There was no regulations on that. I can assure you that if there was some kind of like regulations on that dam, that catastrophe never would have happened.
Yeah.
So that's basically my point.
Jim, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Well said. I appreciate it. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again. Was it Yeren from Ayn Rand?
Yeah, I think the emphasis is on the second syllable. It's Yaron. I think it's Yaron.
Yaron. Okay. It was interesting. He contradicted himself. First, he said in a free market there never were any monopolies. Then he admitted that Standard Oil was a monopoly.
Yeah.
I found that rather funny.
Yeah, because they had the market power to become one. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if Karl Marx's, in my opinion, his prescription was wrong in Das Kapital, but his analysis was accurate, where he suggested that in a laissez-faire capitalist society, you will have, you know, a whole bunch of little fish, and then some of them eat others and become middle fish, and then the middle fish eat the little fish, and then pretty soon you've got just one giant fish that's eaten everybody else, you know, or a small handful of big fish, and boom, we're back to kingdoms and feudalism.
Yeah. I'm guessing that if Standard Oil was lowering the prices, it was probably because they were afraid of antitrust laws.
No, they were lowering the price in order to encourage consumption.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there's and in some cases they were lowering the price to put their competitors out of business.
Right.
The fact of the matter is, as it becomes easier to manufacture something, you can lower the price, and that encourages consumption, and then your profits go up. I mean, there's a delicate balance between, you know, how much you price something. At what point does the price keep people from buying the product? And if you drop it below that price, then you bring in more customers. And if you can bring in more customers so that you're making more money on the volume than you were on the higher profit before, then that's a desirable thing. And so that doesn't mean that laissez-faire capitalism is always going to lead to lower prices. And beyond that, that assumes that lower prices are, you know, an ultimately desirable outcome for all things. And that's not always the case. I mean, you know, there are social goods, for example, as our last caller was talking about, should factor into the equation at the very least.
Yeah.
Julian, got to move along. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. KJ and Camus. Hey, KJ, we just have 20, 30 seconds left. What's up?
Yeah, you missed an adjective when you're describing feudalism, and that's stagnant.
Yeah. Yeah, well said.
Which also begs the question, you know, if we're all flat on our backs, who's going to innovate and keep the ruling class in luxury?
And
to maintain that.
Yeah, and in fact, I would suggest that as monopolies emerge, whether it's sort of the Microsoft monopoly, as it were, or the oil company monopolies in the United States, that innovation is diminished, you know, to the extent that those are monopolies. I'm not suggesting that they're pure monopolies, but yeah, well said. KJ, thanks for the call. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Coming up, confronting Iran, the failure of American foreign policy, and the next great conflict in the Middle East with Ali Ansari. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartmann radio program, 6 minutes past the hour. Ali Ansari is the author of a new book, Confronting Iran, The Failure of American Foreign Policy and the Next Great Conflict in the Middle East. He's a member of the Modern History faculty at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, where he is speaking to us from. He holds a doctorate from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London and has written numerous books and scholarly articles on the history of the Middle East and Iran. Ali Ansari, welcome to the program.
Very good to be with you.
One of the things that I most admire about this book, Confronting Iran, and one of the reasons why I just want to openly recommend it, you know, just encourage my listeners to buy and read this book, is that, and perhaps it's because you're writing from the United Kingdom rather than the United States, but it is an utterly nonpartisan, dispassionate overview of the history, the modern history. It starts in more or less 1953, the modern history of Iran. And there's no political axe to grind in this book, and I want to salute you for that. And in a way, that makes, frankly, that makes the situation, you know, my read of this makes it all the more alarming, from the manipulation of Iran by the Reagan-Bush campaign back during the Carter administration, the screw-ups of the Carter administration, then the Iran-Contra, all the way up to today, and the whole axis of evil thing. Give us a thumbnail sketch of your sense of how Iran got to be where it is right now from, say, 20, 30 years ago, when, at least as you describe in the book, Iran actually admired many of the values of the United States, and in many ways, at least people on the street, admired the United States.
I mean, you're very kind to say what you said, in the sense that it was such a hard book in many ways to write, and I was acutely aware that there are enormous sensitivities on both sides, and I tried very hard to navigate that as far as I could, to try and bring as much balance as I could to the debate. And one of the issues, as you say, is this question that there are two quite distinct narratives of the relationship, one in the United States and one forged in Iran. And these are political narratives. These are narratives really made by the elites about each other, and they tend to be quite disparate, and they tend to look at the other as if they are the source of all the evils that have befallen the other country. Right. Whereas at a social level, what was quite interesting is that at a more sort of societal level, the impact of each other's cultures and attitudes and values are actually fairly similar in some ways. And I thought this was sort of quite ironic that at a political level there could be such enmity, yet at a social level, you know, you found these absurd notions in Iran, for instance, where, you know, the notions of this great Satan and so on and so forth were much more, you know, obviously widespread than necessarily acts of evil got into the lexicon. But you could go to shop sellers in Iran, and they would actually encourage you to buy, you know, Uncle Ben's rice from the great Satan rather than, you know, the local produce, because they always said the produce from the great Satan was better quality. I mean, this sort of thing shows also at a social level how they ridiculed in many ways their political masters. The way they were characterizing the United States just wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that actually a lot of people bought. Mm-hmm. But that didn't mean that they necessarily trusted America's political motives. As much as they admired many of America's achievements, and many of them obviously wanted to go there and be educated there, so on and so forth, if they had the opportunity, yeah. At the same time, there was this political friction, which clearly had been built up over a number of decades with these shared traumatic experiences.
The subtitle of your book, The Failure of American Foreign Policy and the Next Great Conflict in the Middle East, you document actually in the book a series of failures of American foreign policy. What would you say are the most significant among them, and how are the most recent failures of American foreign policy possibly being the segue moment, going to lead us to the next great conflict in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, the most recent, I mean, if I say in recent memory, I mean, let's leave the 1953 episodes to the side now, because they've almost entered folklore in Iran. I mean, that's not, and you can debate, you know, basically the causes and consequences, but certainly the impression is one way. But I think in recent history, for my side of it, it's basically Western, not just American, but Western support for Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, I think, was a monumental mistake. I thought it was very short-sighted. It's true that officially everyone claimed to be neutral and not to take sides, but frankly, the facts show something different. And particularly, and this really affected Iranians in a way that's quite difficult to sort of justify or argue the case. The fact that Saddam Hussein did use chemical and biological weapons on the battlefield, the fact that the West did not protest these strongly enough. I mean,
we supplied them to him, did we not?
Yeah, well, certainly the countries that were European countries that were involved more than the Americans. I mean, in this case, the Americans did not actually supply him with that equipment, but they did not. I mean, I remember talking to a State Department official about this, and he was quite, he was somewhat muted. I mean, he said we did protest, but he accepted that the protest was probably more muted than it should have been. And there was a level of embarrassment. I mean, I always felt for this gentleman from the State Department. And it's similar in the European case. I think in retrospect, many people now admit that didn't show the West in its best light. You know, yes, we may have enemies and so on and so forth, but there are also certain rules of humanity that I think we have to adopt. And if the other side behaves terribly, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to. But it's quite striking that in the Iran-Iraq war, for instance, there was no use of chemical or biological weapons by the Iranians against the Iraqis. I mean, some say it's because they didn't have them, but I think in actual fact they could have used them and they did not. But the use of these sort of weapons to support Saddam Hussein, the decision even at one stage of the Department of Defense to try and concoct a report to say that Iran was responsible for Halabja, for instance. I mean, this is they subsequently then had to bury that because it was clearly nonsense. But, you know, they almost went far too far in that. I mean, other things you can describe as political and a decision to blame Iran for one thing or another for various events. sure if, you know, if there's a political imperative. But the sheer use of, you know, chemical and biological weapons, the support for Saddam Hussein, these sort of things, I think a lot of the Iranians found it very difficult to forgive the West for that. I mean, they felt very bitter about it.
And yet, at the same time,
explanation could solve it, you know.
Right, and yet at the same time, we are now demonizing Iran. It started with George Bush lumping them into this axis of evil.
Yeah,
this
I
was
think
just...
that in recent times, that was a really a very bad mistake. And it also showed, you know, how modern foreign policy works, in a sense, that this was not something done through a State Department, you know, a professional service actually advising the president. This was actually done by political advisors and speechwriters and so on and so forth, and it was really a speech delivered to the American public. But nonetheless, clearly it resonated around the world. It showed no sensitivity to maybe what was going on in Iran at the time, and it did a lot of damage. I mean, it did an enormous amount of damage to Khatami's administration in Iran at the time. I remember talking to British diplomats about the consequences.
Because Iran, at that point in time, before George Bush said those words,
yeah,
Iran was moving in the direction of greater democracy.
And since that time,
it's reversed.
That's right. I mean, that is the point when you can honestly say the thing was dealt a very bad blow. I mean, the problems were started far earlier than that. I mean, it's not as if we mustn't romanticize too much. But certainly, we have to bear in mind that post 9/11, there was a strong sense in Iran that this was the moment for détente, because the United States and Iran shared a number of common enemies, including the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And they basically felt that, you know, we can provide the United States with a certain amount of assistance, which they did, of course, in Afghanistan, and then, of course, this is the reward.
Yeah, this is a very, very important point that I think 95% of Americans are unaware of the fact that Iran, because it's Sunni Muslim, viewed Al-Qaeda, which is a, excuse me, Iran,
the other way around,
Shia
the other way around.
Muslim, viewed Al-Qaeda, which is a Sunni Muslim, you know, organization, and Osama bin Laden as the enemy. And were totally opposed to them, viewed them as a corrupting influence of their religion, and politically, you know, viewed some of the Sunni countries around them, Iraq, for example, with a jaundiced eye.
Well, we have to bear in mind that Iran, you know, condemned the Taliban long before any Western countries. I mean, Iran condemned the Taliban in 1997, I think it was, and then 1998, Iran was on the verge of going to war with Afghanistan.
So we have. I'm sorry, just 1 minute left here. Ali Ansari, the author of Confronting Iran. What do we do now? Where do we go from here?
Well, my view is that there has to be a certain amount of political courage, and we have to bite the bullet and accept that we're going to have some sort of discourse and dialogue at some level. And that doesn't mean that we have to like them. It just means we have to talk to them. I mean, people seem to think that...
it's a rather old-fashioned notion, you know.
Yeah, it's bring back the old-style diplomacy. I mean, I found it quite hilarious to find John Bolton getting up and saying we're not talking to people. I said, well, you know, what is the point of a diplomat if all he's doing is talking to people we like? I mean, you know...
Right.
We have to be talking to people that, you know, we find it difficult to talk to. That's why we have professional diplomats. So I think this is the point, you know, that we need to get to grips with and recognize that simply talking to someone does not necessarily mean we like them or appeasing them or so on and so forth.
Do you think Iran could become an ally?
Sorry?
Do you think Iran could become an ally?
Oh, definitely. I have no doubt about that. If we were to project it 20 years hence, you know, I certainly think even earlier it's very possible.
The question is
getting the right frame.
Yeah. Getting the right friend. It's a tough one. The book is Confronting Iran, The Failure of American Foreign Policy and the Next Great Conflict in the Middle East. The author, Ali Ansari, highly recommended. Check this book out. Ali Ansari, thank you so much for being with
us,
sir.
Thank you very much.
Good speaking with you.
Thank you.
It's 16 minutes past the hour after the break. An update from our John Bolton correspondent in Washington, D.C. Indeed. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling. Show me what it's like. The last one standing, reach me, roll from right. And I'll show you what I can be. Faithful me, faithful me. And I'll leave this life behind me.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Rush Limbaugh. 21 minutes past the hour. Victoria Jones with us on the line, our official senior reigning in the Senate correspondent. It's reigning in the Senate?
Reigning in the Senate, yes. And by the way, I'm a big fan of that Nickelback song. I like that a lot.
Good. I'm glad you like our bumper music.
Yeah, no, so I'm sitting there in this 216 hot room, which is this very posh, big, big room where they hold the important hearings because John Bolton's up for renomination to be U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Mm-hmm. And everything's going along swimmingly. I could give you any number of editorial comments. In fact, I should really include you on my email list of caustic comments that I make during the morning. And suddenly it starts to rain from the ceiling in buckets.
You're kidding.
To the left of John Bolton's desk. Yes, no, it starts to rain very loudly. And
I'm assuming it's raining outside.
No, it's not raining.
Oh, so this is like the wrath of God inside the room.
Yes, exactly. It's the beginning of the seventh plague, so it starts to rain. So the chair, who at that time is Norm Coleman, attempts to call a suspension to it, and Senator Nelson from Florida says, "No, I don't want to suspend. I want to keep going." And Bolton says, "I don't want to suspend. I want to keep going." So they keep going. So they start getting buckets, and they're running out of buckets. So they keep going for about another 10 minutes, and then people look up, and then the rain starts coming down from the other side of Bolton's desk.
Holy cow.
So now the water's coming down from both sides.
You mean out of the ceiling onto his desk?
Not on his desk, no. It's actually to the side of his desk.
You mean, wait a minute. You see, his desk is raining?
No, not his desk. The rain is coming out of the ceiling through the air, landing on the floor on both sides of his desk.
Amazing.
At both sides of his desk. Not actually on the desk, but on the floor.
So it's raining on either side of him.
Thank you.
That's this is like out of a Peanuts comic strip, you know?
It's quite bizarre.
To say the very least. And it's just what? Just water leaking through the roof, a broken pipe or something?
I don't think they knew what it was because it didn't seem to make any sense. They were just running for buckets. When Senator Barack Obama arrived towards the end, he didn't really know what to do. And so he took his normal place and started to ask questions. And then he had to move because the splashes were so huge.
Well, the two questions that I would want to ask very quickly are, number one, was there a meeting of U.N. ambassadors in the room above? And number two, was the water yellow?
Well, Senator Nelson from Florida actually said that he hoped it was water and not something else.
Yeah, John Bolton has certainly made some enemies. I said a very bad taste joke. My apologies to anybody in the audience who's offended, but you know,
Senator Nelson beat you to it.
Yeah, I good for him. It's just because John Bolton has, that's the metaphor that some ambassadors have essentially used to say that, you know, what he's doing to the United Nations.
Exactly.
You know, that he has treated the United Nations with the least of respect and other ambassadors. And interesting. But it looks like this is going to be a love fest now that George Voinovich has retracted, as it were, what he said. Now, let me just, for our listeners who may be unfamiliar, just play George Voinovich's speech on the floor of the Senate. This is, 6 months ago or so? Would this have been, Victoria?
Yes, about that.
Here
yeah.
we are. George Voinovich, the Republican from Ohio, who's the guy who basically stopped Bolton's confirmation.
We're going to vote tomorrow, and I'm afraid that when we go to the well, that too many of my colleagues are not going to understand that this appointment is very, very important to our country. At a strategic time when we need friends all over the world, we need somebody up there that's going to be able to get the job done.
Voinovich is crying.
I know some of my friends say, "Don't let it go, George, it's going to work out. I don't want to take the risk. I came back here and ran for a second term because I'm worried about my kids and my grandchildren. And I just hope my colleagues will take the time, and before they get to this well, do some serious thinking about whether or not we should send John Bolton to the United Nations."
So what has caused George Voinovich to change his mind, Victoria Jones? He's not running for re-election.
It wasn't really clear to me today, listening to Voinovich, what was it caused him to change his mind, to be really honest with you, and I listened pretty carefully. the Republican theme that's coming through and that was strongly criticized by Senator Barbara Boxer, who gave a very lucid, eloquent speech, is basically continuity. The argument seems to be, we've got somebody in there, it's a difficult time in the world, we need continuity. And this is the theme that's repeated again and again and again. And it's actually a brilliant talking point, because it's something that on the face of it sounds so reasonable.
How about we need competence? We need somebody who knows actually how to be a diplomat and talk to other people. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, are the Democrats going along with this?
No, they're not. And in fact, the most contentious exchange, really quite pugnacious on both sides, was John Kerry, who went way over time. He was the last senator, and he really went after Bolton, particularly on North Korea. And he was furious. Feingold went after him. Dodd went after him. Sarbanes went after him.
Interesting.
No,
I
would say the Democrats went after him.
Will you have those clips at talkradionews.com?
We will do.
We'll take a look for them. Thank you very much. Victoria Jones, our reigning in the Senate senior correspondent for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thanks.
27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You know the world be rocking to it, to it, so do it, do it, do it. Bounce with it, drop with it, lean with it, rock with it, tap with it. All my fellas, put your hands with it, do it, do it, do it. You know the world be rocking to it, to it.
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as named by George Bush Sr., also known as Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting coast to coast and around the world. And time now for our Catherine Harris alert for the day. I thought we had a Catherine Harris alert. Oh, hang on just a second. Here we go.
Well, if we make this coat, it would be as if I were wearing your dog.
Yes, our official Catherine Harris alert theme music. Democrat Howard Dean called Republican Senate candidate Catherine Harris a crook and compared her to Stalin, as the Florida Sun Sentinel writes. Josh Hoffenbrock's column. The right wing all upset about this. They're all bloviating Dean called her, said she's like Stalin. What? Stalin killed millions of people. Catherine Harris only disenfranchised a couple hundred thousand African Americans. She just kept black people from voting. That's, you know, Stalin actually killed people. I mean, how can you make a comparison?
Well, what Howard Dean was referring to, for those of you who have to calm down your conservative friends who listen to the right-wing talk shows or get the right-wing emails, what Howard Dean was referring to is the famous and possibly apocryphal, but famous quote from Joseph Stalin that, "It's not who votes that matters. It's who counts the votes that matters." And there's, you know, variations on that quote all over the place. Most of them attributed to Joe Stalin. And, in fact, here's what Howard Dean actually said. He said, "Thank God for Bill Nelson." This is the Democratic congressman from Florida. He said, against whom Catherine Harris is running. He said, "Thank God for Bill Nelson, because we'd have another crook in the United States Senate if it wasn't for him. He's going to beat the pants off Catherine Harris." Not an image I'd like to hold in mind. She doesn't understand, Howard Dean said, that it's improper to be chairman of a campaign and count the votes at the same time. Obviously referring there to 2000, where she was chairman of the Bush-Cheney campaign and was the Secretary of State counting the votes. And then he went on to say, "This is not Russia and she is not Stalin." Sounds pretty straightforward to me. So good on you, Howard Dean, for outing Catherine Harris, as it were. Here's a story that really illustrates the challenge. And this is a real challenge that we're going to be facing, that Democrats and progressives are going to be facing in this upcoming election. It has already started.
It has already started. This is from an article in These Times, written by Joel Bleifuss. You can read it over at inthesetimes.com. MoveOn.org has put together some ads. As MoveOn PAC director Eli Pariser says, the most visible and insidious form of corruption is the form that's also legal, and that is the money politicians take from big companies and the votes that they give in return to help these companies. For example, Deborah Price. She's the fourth-ranking GOP leader in the House of Representatives. She's from suburban Columbus, Ohio. And so MoveOn.org put together an ad. It's on the screen. There's a dossier file and a photograph of Congresswoman Price. And the announcer says, Congresswoman Deborah Price, she accepted more than $100,000 from energy companies, and she voted against bills that would have penalized those companies for price gouging. And then on the screen, you see a series of black and white photographs of Representative Price. The announcer says, instead of protecting us, Congresswoman Price has been caught red-handed protecting oil company profits while we pay more at the pump. And then on the screen, you see a close-up of her hand, and in one of the photos, as if there was an invisible brush, it paints her hand red. And then the announcer wraps up the commercial by saying, Tom DeLay, Dick Cheney, Jack Abramoff, and now Deborah Price, another Republican caught red-handed. Now, they have put together ads like this for about four Republican members of Congress who have been taking big bucks from the energy companies and then voting for the energy companies, or big bucks from the drug companies and voting with the drug companies, you know, on and on it goes. Basically, Republican members of Congress who've been bought off, and they're pointing it out. One about her, about Representative Price in Ohio. Another about Representative Nancy Johnson, Republican in Connecticut. Another about Thelma Drake, Republican in Virginia. And another one about Congressman Chris Ciccola in Indiana. Or maybe it's Ciccola. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. C-H-O-C-O-L-A. These are very powerful ads. They're truthful ads. These are not like the Swift Boat ads where they get where they're actually running lies. These are truthful ads, and they're very powerful. Second ad concentrates on votes by the four that prohibited the federal government from negotiating lower prices with the drug companies. The ad aimed at Representative Johnson shows a grandmotherly figure empty a pill bottle into her hand as the voiceover says, seniors relied on her, yet Congresswoman Johnson accepted $400,000 from big drug companies and got caught red-handed voting for a law that actually prevents Medicare from negotiating lower prices for our seniors. That's all the ad says. A third takes the representatives, this is another ad from MoveOn.org, that takes them to task for votes against a bill that would have instituted criminal penalties against war profiteers like Halliburton. As a fistful of money changes hands, this is from this article by Joel Bleifuss in These Times, as a fistful of money changes hands, a voiceover reads, Congresswoman Thelma Drake accepted $25,000 from defense contractor PAX. Then she opposed penalties for defense contractors like Halliburton, who overcharged the military in Iraq at a time when soldiers didn't have enough body armor. And indeed, in March, Drake actually did vote against a Democratic bill that would have blocked firms that have been found to overcharge the government by $100 million or more from receiving any further contracts. So here you have three ads against four members of Congress that are very powerful and very truthful. Now MoveOn.org goes out and tries to buy TV time for them. And this is where the story gets really serious. This is where the story gets into something that, frankly, you and I need to be concerned about. We need to be concerned about big time. On June 9th, the RNC sent a letter to the television stations that MoveOn.org was buying ads on in these various congressional districts. The letter said, these ads are reckless, malicious, and false, casting Ms. Drake in a false light by accusing him, obviously it's about a woman, but they said him, this is boilerplate language, by accusing him of unsubstantiated criminal conduct. We also believe the republication of these allegations by your organization subjects your organization to the same potential liability for defamation as MoveOn.org. In other words, the Republican National Committee, the RNC, is threatening the television stations with lawsuits for defamation, for running political ads that are truthful. Now, every single one of these TV stations ran the Swift boat ads in the 2004 election, every one of them. So, are they going to run these truthful ads for MoveOn.org? Well, as Joel Blyfus writes, and in these times, in Virginia, Cox Communications, citing business risks, agreed to stop running the ad attacking Representative Drake. Tom Prevett, a Cox Communications spokesman and vice president, told Norfolk's Virginian Pilot, quote, "In this case, it's prudent for us to discontinue running those ads for business reasons," end quote. Uh-huh. Dig a little deeper, you discover that Tom Prevett, the Cox Communications spokesman, contributed $500 to the Republican Drake's campaign, as did another Cox vice president, Franklin R. Bowers. In Indiana, South Bend's WSB-TV, WSB-TTV, a CBS affiliate, pulled the ad attacking Representative Chocola, while in Connecticut, Hartford's NBC affiliate, WVIT, refused to take the ad. And the GOP had its greatest success cowing the media in Columbus, Ohio. Two Sinclair-owned stations, the ABC affiliate WSYX-TV and the Fox affiliate WTTE-TV, pulled the ads. In response, MoveOn's Pariser issued this statement. He said, "Isn't it ironic that the Swift boat veterans can lie on Sinclair-owned affiliates, but the public is shut out from learning information in the public record about Representative Price?" The GENBC affiliate in Columbus, Ohio, WCMH-TV, declined MoveOn's ad dollars as well, although they did take money from the Swift boat veterans in the 2004 election. In Columbus, the Time Warner station, WXYX-TV in Columbus, refused to run the ads. Turns out the president of that division, Rhonda Fraze, contributed $2,000 to GOP candidates in Ohio since 2003. So much for the liberal media. And in Columbus with WBNS-TV, which turned down the ad, general manager Tom Griesdorn, he pulled the ad. I mean, it just goes on and on. It gets even more bizarre. John Wolf, the CEO of Dispatch Media Group, the corporation that owns WBNS-TV, has donated $3,000 to the GOP since 1998. That's nothing compared with his wife, Ann, who since 1998 has contributed $48,100 to the Republican cause, including $2,100 to Representative Price, who, along with Wolf, resides in the Tony Columbus suburb of Upper Arlington. They also own the local newspaper, the Columbus Dispatch. So the local newspaper is not talking about the fact that the local TV station is refusing to run the ads for MoveOn.org that out the local congresswoman, who happens to be a Republican, for taking all this money from the defense contractors and the drug companies. In addition, the Columbus Dispatch has let stand Price's claim that she has no connection to Abramoff.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Some people look for saints, for saviors from above. Some people look for justice, or for everlasting life. Whatever way you go, corporations try to track. We're way too deep in corporate hell. There ain't no turning back. It's just a shame.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, it's a shame. It's truly a shame. So to bring this thing back around, here we have all these radio stations and all these congressional districts, or television stations and all these congressional districts all across the United States, who are refusing to carry MoveOn.org's ad, even though they carried the Swift boat ads. Refusing to carry the ads, giving a variety of excuses, from bad business decision to we're afraid the Republicans will sue us to no excuse at all. Hey, we just don't want to take their money. There's still this myth of the liberal media out there. What should we do about it? Well, time for our activism alert.
May take all week, may take long out. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, well. Taking over! Come on!
Yeah, come on. First of all, educate yourself about this issue. Go over to InThesetimes.com and check out the article on this topic. InThesetimes.com, the article is, If the Paint Sticks, Sling It. And just read the article. I shared with you just excerpts from it a few minutes ago. And then call your member of Congress and say, I'm really concerned about media consolidation and the relationship between and media deregulation. And that it is allowing this sort of thing to happen, this unholy alliance between big media and Republicans. And I would like you to do something about it. There's not one specific piece of legislation. There's probably 100 that could impact this in one way or another, including stuff that has to do with the FCC. Certainly, we should go back and roll back what Bill Clinton did in 1996 with the Telecommunications Act. Obviously, go back to revisit what Reagan did in 1987 when he set aside the Fairness Doctrine. Not that I'm calling for a return of the Fairness Doctrine, but there were a whole bunch of things that went along with it that really, really should be reexamined. So go over to InThesetimes.com. If you don't already subscribe to In These Times, it's great. It's worth subscribing to. But you can also read it online and read the article, If the Paint Sticks, Sling It. And then call your member of Congress, toll-free, 888-355-3588. Your senators, your member of the House of Representatives, and let them know what you think. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana on the line. Hey, Sean, thanks for calling. What's
hey,
up?
Tom, and you know, I think it would be a great idea for the White Rose Society to, or at least the website, to put that on bumper stickers and T-shirts and use that as a fundraiser, that number.
Oh, the toll-free number?
Huh?
The toll-free number for Congress, you mean?
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd stick it on all my articles I write for InSpin.
Good. It actually belongs to somebody. There is a number of organizations out there that have toll-free numbers for Congress.
Yeah.
And, for example, some of the socially conscious investment groups, unions, whatnot, they pay for the toll-free number, and it goes into Congress. And I frankly don't know whose number that is. I've never been able to figure it out, because I'd like to give them credit for it. It's a very memorable number. That we used to have the old SOB number.
That
was
and that was the greatest one.
Right, and they disconnected that one during the John Roberts hearings, and I think it's because it was costing somebody too much money. Because when you call these toll-free numbers, somebody's picking up the bill for 4 or 5 cents a minute for that call.
Well, we should find out if there's a Republican organization that owns an 800 number to the Capitol switchboard and
that's a good point. There are a number of conservative organizations that give out toll free numbers to call Congress and see. You can go to any purveyor of toll free numbers and get a toll free number and simply say I want it to ring into, and then you give them the actual number of Congress, which is 202-225-3121. And it just rings in on top of that.
Well, I'll do some investigating and find out if there is a Republican or a conservative group that puts out the 800 number and we can start giving out that.
The problem with doing that intentionally, Sean, is then I'd be doing it maliciously, and I just, you know, it,
no,
it's...
No, we're just doing it for people that can afford it more than the professor.
I have certain ethical boundaries here, you know, like I said. But in any case, that's not what you called about. What did you call it?
No, I called about the whole net neutrality thing that you were talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
There are countries and there's a large number of people, and this is being brought up all over the Internet, that are so concerned about the neutrality of the Internet that has been around, you know, since the Internet was created, that they want the backbone of the Internet to move out of Stanford and go into some other place in another country that's more neutral.
And or have it regulated by the United Nations rather than the United States.
Yeah, but you're not going to sell that to the American people nearly as easy. I mean, I don't want the UN to have the backbone either. I want a neutral country.
Yeah.
The UN
is
supposed to be neutral, but...
Here's the problem, though, Sean. Every country has their own primary backbone. I mean, the Internet in China, for example, very heavily censored.
Yeah.
Because the Chinese are there's no net neutrality in China.
Yeah, I know, but the Stanford one, the one that's at Stanford, is like the biggest backbone on the Internet.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and I hate to say this, but I think it's probably a good idea, at least until things calm down here.
Yeah, to move it to a third country. Good point. Sean, thanks for the call,
All
and thanks for your always thoughtful and pithy insights. Good to hear from you, Sean. Thanks for listening to us there in Indianapolis. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour with Sasha Abramsky talking about voter disenfranchisement. Con, how millions went to prison, lost the vote, and helped send George W. Bush to the White House? Interesting. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Sasha Abramsky is with us. She's the author of a new book, Conned. It's actually, the pre-subtitle is A Compelling Journey Through Disenfranchised America. Then the title is Conned. Then the subtitle is How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. This, I suspect, is going to come as a shocker, as a revelation to many Americans. 5 million Americans pulled off the voting rolls or potential voting rolls because of a prison industry run amok. Sasha Abramsky, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you with us. I got your gender wrong. I'm sorry, Sasha. In fact, we've spoken before. And Sasha, the whole idea here that if somebody has committed a crime and paid their service to society, you know, done their penance, as it were, they've gone to prison, they've suffered through whatever you call it after prison, you know. The period of time, there's a...
They've been on parole.
Parole, thank you. And all that kind of thing. And you know, it's done with. And yet, still, in most states, they can't vote.
Well, it's an extraordinary problem. Basically, what's happened is there are these 19th century laws on the books, not in most states, but in many states, including Florida, which is a huge state, obviously. And these laws say that if you get a felony record, the default presumption is you can never vote again. Now, there are ways to get your vote back, even in a state like Florida, but they're very, very cumbersome, expensive, and time-consuming. The result is that in an era in which we're using incarceration more and more frequently, we're giving more and more Americans felony records, oftentimes for relatively low-end offenses. In such an era, the result is mass disenfranchisement. To put it in perspective, there's only one other time in American history where so many people have so quickly been removed from the voter rolls, and that's during the imposition of Jim Crow at the tail end of the 19th century. So this is an issue with extraordinary import for our democratic process.
Interesting. During the imposition of Jim Crow, tell us about that.
Well, when Jim Crow was imposed, about a decade to two decades after the end of the Civil War, very, very conservative white Southern politicians were looking for ways to legally disenfranchise ex-slaves. And because of the 14th and 15th Amendments, they couldn't do anything as straightforward as saying, if you're black, you cannot vote. So what the leadership in the South did was they created a series of legal mechanisms which they knew would have the impact of disenfranchising African Americans. So they created a poll tax, which obviously if you're very, very poor and you have no steady income, you're not going to be able to pay. They introduced a literacy test, and obviously many ex-slaves, the majority of ex-slaves, had never been educated and therefore couldn't read sufficiently, therefore were disenfranchised by the literacy test. They introduced property requirements. Now, one of the other things they did was to rework the felon codes. Now, a lot of states from the 1830s and 1840s on in had felon disenfranchisement. What happened in the post-Civil War South was the disenfranchisement laws were tailored to specifically target the kinds of crimes that Southern leaders thought blacks were more likely to commit. So you see from the 1870s on in, felon disenfranchisement becomes a prop of Jim Crow. Now, obviously, we're in a slightly different historical period today. There isn't such a crude relationship between race and disenfranchisement. But you do see, especially with the war on drugs, a dramatic overuse of the criminal justice system throughout the country against African Americans. Now, the result of that is when you tie disenfranchisement to felonies, even in non-Southern states, in Washington state, in Nevada, in Iowa, in states that are outside the South but still have very, very restrictive felon disenfranchisement laws, even in those states, you see an extraordinary statistic. You see somewhere in the region of 1 in 5 to 1 in 4 black men in those states voteless. And they've become voteless without anybody paying any attention. When you go through the South, when you go to the Mississippi Delta, when you go to Alabama, and these are all states I've visited. I wrote my book as a travelogue. So I went across the country talking with people, trying to chronicle this extraordinary disenfranchisement saga. And when you go into the rural South in particular, you find communities where 1 in 3 black men cannot vote. To my mind, that's staggering. It's happened without anybody paying attention. Until recently, it's happened without anybody raising a voice in opposition to it.
Well, and fact,
yet, it's serving to decimate the political participation amongst poor minority communities.
Well, and then it's even extended beyond that. In the 2000 election, you had 70, 80, 90,000 African Americans pulled off the voting rolls in Florida because a felon with a similar name happened to live in Texas.
That's right. There was an extraordinary story unfolded there. Now, Florida has the single largest disenfranchisement problem in the country. It takes away the vote from upwards of 750,000 people at this point, which is 7% of the adult population.
That's mind-boggling. Now,
it's staggering in its implications. Let me just say this, Tom. It got worse than that. They erroneously, as you said, took away the vote from people who just shared a name or a similar name to that of a felon. So you had this double layer of disenfranchisement there.
Right. And then in the 2002 election, Jeb Bush was under court order to put those people back on the list, and he didn't do it.
That's right. In fact, in 2004, the state tried the same thing. They tried to hire another private company with a similar mandate. Their mandate was to, quote-unquote, scrub the voter rolls, which is a rather Orwellian sound, if you like. You'd think a state government wouldn't want to scrub the voter rolls of political participants.
Yeah.
But they did try to do this again, and they almost succeeded, except there really was a media outcry this time.
I'm curious.
They were embarrassed into abandoning the list eventually.
Yeah, I'm curious. Sasha Abramski, the author of Conned, and by the way, on the web it's Conned the Book, or Sasha Abramski, ABRAMSKY.com. And there is a strong body of evidence that suggests that the private prison industry, the drug testing industry, and I used to have a friend back in the 70s who was making drug tests and selling them through High Times magazine. I mean, he was a chemist, and he was selling these things out of his garage. And it was like, you know, 5-10 cents worth of materials, and it was so people could actually measure if the pot that they were getting was any good, you know, that kind of thing. He was selling drug tests to drug users. And I remember in the late 1970s when the first industries started requiring drug testing, my friend Stanley became a multimillionaire over the course of a couple of years and has now retired. He's got a great big huge mansion in Bel Air. And, you know, he's become a multimillionaire from the drug testing industry. I mean, this is a huge business, you know, selling 20 cents worth of chemicals for $40, and it's mandated and millions of people have to take them. So you've got the drug testing industry, and then you've got the private prison industry, which has become, you know, one of the largest construction growth industries in the United States, pushing for stronger and harsher laws, particularly drug laws. And the fallout of that has been the disenfranchisement, or at least the arrest and incarceration, of a lot of African-American men, because that's the low-hanging fruit, the easy pickings, because there's no job opportunities in those communities, and so you have people becoming entrepreneurs. But there's nothing they can become entrepreneurial around, except perhaps, you know, hey, you want to buy some pot or some crack. So I would suggest that those two industries have actually worked in Congress to try and strengthen these laws because it's more profitable for them. Are you suggesting that there are politicians who are also promoting these kinds of laws because they know that the consequence will be that it will disenfranchise potential Democratic voters because, by and large, African Americans traditionally vote Democratic?
I'm not sure it's quite that straightforward. I think what's happened is over the last 30 years, a very, very potent prison industrial complex has emerged. And that means there's private industry, there's political interests, there's bureaucracies, there are correctional officers, trade unions, all of whom have a stake in maintaining an extremely large, bloated, historically anomalous prison population. We now put in prison 2.2 million people. We have the largest incarcerated population on earth, which is a staggeringly bad thing to have. We spend $40,000 or $50,000 per person per year that we incarcerate. It's a drain on public resources. It takes money out of the education sector. It reduces the amount of money to spend on social programs, on mental health services, and so on. It's a series of very, very bad public policies that have been locked into place. But every step of the way, there are these vested interests that have a stake in it. So obviously, private prisons have a stake in promoting prison growth. Industries that deal business-wise with the prison sector similarly have an interest. Tough-on-crime politicians who've gotten elected through spouting very, very simplistic soundbite policy approaches to drugs especially.
Yeah. So bottom line, we just have 15 seconds left here. Sasha Abramsky, are you suggesting that if disenfranchisement laws were not on the books, that George Bush would not be president right now?
Absolutely. If you look at the numbers, enough people from low-income demographics have been taken out of the process to seriously impact every election from the local all the way up to the presidential. It's having a stark impact on the democratic workings of the country.
Amazing. Something we should know about and we should do something about. Cond the Book, the website, condthebook.com. The book, of course, Cond. Sasha Abramsky. Sasha, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Great speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
Making my country proud. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
As we're taking our country back, my friends, congressional district by congressional district, every week we try to feature progressives who are running for Congress and worthy of your support, worthy of getting out there and supporting these folks. Today we have with us Bill Durston. He's running for the 3rd Congressional District in California. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
The website, Bill Durston's website, Durston, D-U-R-S-T-O-N, for Congress, F-O-R, Congress.org. And Bill Durston, looking at the map of the 3rd Congressional District of California, looks like it's mostly Sacramento County and areas to the east, going all over to the Nevada border. Is that
That's right.
A good way to describe it?
It's gerrymandered. The major population density is in the eastern part of Sacramento County, reaches all the way down to the Delta part of Solano County, and then all the way to the Nevada-California border in Alpine County. I say it looks like a lobster with the tail and body being toward Nevada and then the claws being toward the San Francisco Delta.
Right, and you're running against Dan Lundgren, who's the incumbent right now,
That's
Republican.
Right.
And so let's just go through a few of the issues. I've spent a little time on your website, Durston for Congress, D-U-R-S-T-O-N-F-O-R, congress.org, and I encourage our listeners to go check it out. And if you like what you hear, to pitch in, help out, support Bill Durston, whether it's with volunteering for his campaign or contributing money to his campaign or passing the good word along. What do you see as the top issues?
You know, I'm an emergency physician, and I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I look at the campaign from the same points of view as I did in the military and the ER, and that is, where are the life threats? Now, there's a life threat in Iraq and the rest of the Middle East. There's a life threat in medical care, with a large proportion of our population having little or no access to affordable medical care. And there's a life threat to our democracy, with an administration that feels it can violate U.S. law, violate the U.S. Constitution, violate the Geneva Convention, and the Congress, for the most part, that hasn't had the courage to check these abuses.
Bill Durston, durstonforcongress.org, the website. What's your take on George W. Bush and his signing statements?
You know, it's just a sign that he believes that he is above the law, even bills passed by Congress, not to mention, the UN UN treaty or the United Nations Charter and the Geneva Convention and the Constitution. It's frankly that he feels that, for example, on the ban on torture, that he can define what torture is and what torture is not.
Right. I noticed about four or five months ago or so, the Republicans were sending out talking points. I get all the Republican talking points here because we do this talk show, and they're just hysterical about, oh my God, if you elect Democrats, they will impeach George W. Bush, and they thought that was actually going to scare people, that it would cause people not to vote for Democrats. And then all of a sudden, after about 3 weeks of this, and it was a really concerted effort. I mean, they were all over the talk shows and everything. They suddenly stopped talking about it, and apparently what happened was they did some internal polling, and they discovered that the majority of Americans actually think that George W. Bush should be investigated for impeachable offenses, and possibly even a majority of Republicans think that. I noticed on your website you take a position on impeachment, which I salute you for, and I wanted you to give you an opportunity to talk about that to our listeners, Bill Durston.
Sure. There's no question in my mind that George W. Bush should be impeached. Impeachment, as you know, means to put the official, in this case George Bush, on trial. It doesn't necessarily mean to remove him from office. But I believe there's overwhelming evidence that Bush has violated federal law and that he knowingly misled the people and the Congress of our country into a war based on entirely false pretenses. Impeachment is not some radical scheme. It is one of the checks and balances built into our Constitution by the founders of our country. And in a situation like this, where our democracy is at stake, this check needs to be put in place. There's no question in my mind, as I've said before and as is on the website, I will support articles of impeachment, and if someone else doesn't introduce them, I'll introduce them myself against both Bush and Cheney.
We're talking to Bill Durston. He's running as a Democrat against the Republican Dan Lundgren. Bill Durston in California's 3rd Congressional District. Bill Durston's website, Durston, D-U-R-S-T-O-N, for F-O-R, Congress.org. Please check it out. Bill, we just have about a half a minute left here. Labor and the plight of the middle class in America, your take on this?
You know, the gap between the rich and the poor is getting ever wider. As you know, the Bush administration and my opponent have given huge tax breaks to the rich while we cut services for the rest of the working people of our country. Our government is no longer of the people, by the people, for the people. It's of, by, and for special interests. And we need to change that. And that's why I've stepped down from my work in emergency medicine to run for Congress, because we have an emergency in our country, both here at home and as far as our international policy goes.
Well said. Well said. Bill Durston.
Our democracy.
Bill Durston. He's running for Congress against Dan Lundgren and worthy of your support. Go check it out. www.durston, D-U-R-S-T-O-N, 4, F-O-R, Congress.org, his website. Bill, I wish you the very best.
Thanks, Tom.
Wish you well in your campaign. 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
We gotta take the power back.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Our phone number, 866-440-8466, toll free across the United States. You want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. Let's find out what's happened in the last 24 hours with regard to the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the man in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children
The following are the security and other developments in Iraq as of Thursday, 08:45 Greenwich Mean Time. Baghdad, the toll from a car bombing and mortar effects in central Baghdad climbed to at least 25 people killed and 45 wounded, according to the Ministry of Interior. A roadside in near Tikrit, a roadside bomb killed two policemen and wounded two others. In Ishaqi, a roadside bomb in the city of, in that city north of Baghdad killed one civilian and wounded four. In Kirkuk, a policeman and an Iraqi soldier were killed after the patrols opened fire on each other near a gas station in the town of Debs. In Baghdad, two mortar shells hit the Dora district of southern Baghdad on Wednesday, wounding four civilians. In Baqaba, a car bomb exploded in the city of Baqaba, north of Baghdad, wounding three people. In Mosul, a policeman was wounded when gunmen opened fire on him in that city. Also in Baqaba, a roadside bomb exploded beside an ambulance as it headed to Baqaba Hospital, killing five people and wounding four. And in Kirkuk, an army lieutenant was wounded and a soldier was killed when gunmen attacked their car in the city of Kirkuk, 250 kilometers north of Baghdad. Grim. Got an email here, a note. Yesterday I went on a rant about Halliburton and suggested that Halliburton was doing the mess hall stuff and paying people $150,000 a year to do it. A fellow in the U.S. Army, based in Camp Anaconda in Iraq, sent me a note. I'm not going to name him for obvious reasons. He says, "Tom, thanks for the great program. I podcast you every day here at LSA Anaconda, Iraq. You are one of two people who have inspired me to make my own podcast from here, but that's not why I'm writing." He said, "When you mentioned Halliburton employees making $150,000 a year to peel potatoes, I had to let you know that the situation is actually much uglier than that. The actual KBR worker is usually little more than a slave for all intents and purposes. They're paid very little and are kept in very crowded living quarters. Most are Filipinos, Bangladeshis, and from India, although there are also some Nepalese as well. Recently, General Casey mandated better treatment for them, including the forbidding of passport confiscation and excessive job broker fees and minimum acceptable living space." He says, "Personally, I'm sure this is the type of guest worker program the cons have in mind for the U.S. It would be much easier for the companies to maintain control over workers from countries or cultures with a relatively small representation among the general populace of the U.S. Latin American workers could too easily slip into the Spanish-speaking areas of our country if they get fed up with poor treatment or conditions and decide to break their contracts. A Bangladeshi worker, by contrast, could more easily be found and returned to his or her contract holder. Perhaps the day will come when we see ads in the paper for contract breaker return specialists. Didn't we have a similar occupation in the early 1800s? Yes, we did. We had vigilantes who went after runaway slaves. Yep. He says, "Thanks again for the great show. I'm sick of being a war criminal and will not re-enlist." So, good on you, sir. Thank you very much for your service to our country and for your dedication to the truth and to learning what's going on. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bill in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Long time no talk to you. I've been getting more and more concerned as I'm starting to hear leaks coming out of the Iraqi area and the troubles going on with Israel about the possibility of hinting that there's more increased likelihood of attack or some kind of a problem. And
attack against Iran, are you talking about?
No, against us.
Against us.
I've been hearing little leaks on the radio saying that, on television, it's more likely that because of Lebanon that there'll be possible attacks in America because they might lease these groups of folks that have been laying in dormant.
Yeah. Yeah, and Zawahiri, the number two guy in Al-Qaeda, he's actually the mentor of Osama bin Laden. People don't get that right. He's the pediatrician from, I believe, Afghanistan. In any case, he just came out and basically declared jihad against us for our support of Israel
right.
in that situation.
But even before he did that, I had started to hear little leaks about our vulnerability, referring to either epidemic things like disease or another attack on American territory. And when you tie that together with the fact that some of the recent the recent rulings of the Supreme Court about the hostages and the torture, and those are all war crime type situations. The blockage of the port deal, the prevention of Gonzalez's investigation. They admitted that the president stopped the investigation. He's already declared that he's not going to continue the investigation, the contract with the special prosecutor from Chicago.
Patrick Fitzgerald.
Yeah, he said he's not. He said at a press conference, "I don't know why I should continue that." Blah blah blah. But anyway. He originally had put that executive order 13303 together to protect all the crimes that they were expecting to commit in Iraq, and created a corporation called Iraq Inc. And so with all that going on, he knows that he's going to be impeached if they lose the election. So right. I expect that they're not going to let this die down. They want to carry this full bore between now and November, so that he has either some way to delay the election. Or to change public opinion.
Yeah, I don't think there are people who say he's going to want to delay the election or call off the election and like mm-hmm. that. I don't think he has to do that. All he has to do, I mean, remember the anthrax attack? There were two guys who were standing between us and the Patriot Act. You had mm-hmm. in the United States Senate, Tom Daschle, who was the head of the Senate, who could decide whether
right.
or not a bill came for a vote.
Right.
And you had Pat Leahy of Vermont, who was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the committee through which the Patriot Act had to pass. And those two Democratic senators who controlled the fate of the Patriot Act, because Jim Jeffords had dropped his Republican Party affiliation and thrown control of the Senate to the Democrats, those two Democratic senators were the only two people who could stop the passage of the Patriot Act, and they were both making noises like they were going to, or at least slow it down so that it could be carefully gone through.
Right.
And guess who the only two members of the United States Senate were who got anthrax in the mail?
Right.
Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy,
right.
those two guys. And we still don't, gee, what a coincidence. We don't know who sent that anthrax. We're not even sure anybody's looking for them. And so I just, it wouldn't surprise me at all, Bill, to see either some phony kind of attack, and not to say that the anthrax attack was phony. I mean, people died. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, some possibly manufactured in the United States attack by Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Or some external attack, like we saw 9/11, apparently external. I mean, that's still up in the air in my mind. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see something happen before the November election, and then these guys will get on their high horse and say, be afraid, be very afraid, therefore vote for us.
Well, there's been mercenaries that we hired, so-called there for protection of the executives, that have been accused of actually attacking people in Iraq wearing uniforms that made them look like Iraqis.
Yeah.
And there were
a couple of British soldiers who were busted for that a couple of months ago, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot of these attacks that have been done to rile up the people and create these civil war events have been accused. So it wouldn't take very much to bring somebody like that or Blackwater like they did in Katrina. And there's a law that he had passed, some kind of executive order that said that if a certain situation existed, that he could then exercise military rule.
And yeah, well, actually, Richard Nixon passed that. I think that...
Well, they have a new version of it.
Yeah, it's been updated a number of times, particularly with the FEMA laws. But this is where I suspect, Bill, you and I may part company. I don't think that George W. Bush, that the outcome that's going down in Iraq right now is what he wanted. I think that, if he wants to declare a state of emergency, all he has to do is create, I mean, it's the Northwood scenario all over again. I mean, where the U.S. Army actually seriously considered phoning up a plane to look like a Castro plane, like a Cuban plane, and shooting down a U.S. Domestic airliner over the skies of Florida. They ultimately decided not to, but it was seriously considered, and it was floated all the way up to the Pentagon and Operation Northwoods. If he's that Machiavellian, he doesn't have to screw things up that badly in Iraq. I think that's just plain old bumbling incompetence and criminal malfeasance combined with this bizarre libertarian ideology.
Well, they want Iraq to fail because they say they're against a civil war, but they really want a civil war because that keeps them there. They didn't build that embassy for nothing.
Yeah.
And this thing with Lebanon, I
agree, but I'm saying that that's not for domestic purposes. That's just for profit.
Right.
But have you, for their have buddies.
You, Well, I don't know. I think it's part of the plan to have our military forces close by where they can hit Iran, because the Operation Clean Break also says that this was part of a larger...
Okay, I'll agree with you on that. Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. It makes sense. Bill, I got to take a break. Thanks a lot for the call.
They have to keep going.
Yeah, they do have to keep going. A lot of good points that you got in there. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio programming program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If I had one prayer to pull out thin air, everyone, everywhere would be happy. Yeah, we'd hand out.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. That's what we're doing, my friends. You and I and all the other folks out there who are working so hard to take back this constitutionally limited democratic republic to conform to the conservative political correct language. But it is. It is a constitutionally limited democratic republic. To take it back for we the people instead of them the corporations. Oren in Essex Junction, Vermont on the line. Hey, Oren, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening to us there on WVAA in Burlington. What's up?
Hey Tom. Sorry to be so long checking in with you. I'm doing great today, but I'll get better. How are you doing?
The same, Oren. Thank you.
Hey... Tom, I'm listening to this. I'm kind of in and out today. I'm listening to this gentleman with this book review, interview, first hour, talking about his premise for his book, I believe it was, is that the Bush administration is basically doing, they have noble intent, maybe they're trying to do things right, but their outcome is misguided.
With regard to Iran, are you talking about?
And with regard to Iran?
Yeah, no, he never suggested that they have noble intent. He drew no conclusions about their intent whatsoever. What he points out in his book is that our policies with regard to Iran, and you know, going back all the way to 1953, but particularly the policies of the last 4 years with regard to Iran, have been very, very successful at turning what could have been a potential ally and into a potential serious enemy, and in turning the people of Iran, the Iranian street, as it were, from being very, very overtly, so overtly pro-American that on 9/12, the day after 9/11, there was a candlelight vigil in downtown Tehran with hundreds of thousands of people in solidarity with America, because the Iranians view al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden as their enemy. There has turned the Iranian street from basically loving America, buying American products, emulating America, wanting to emulate American style of democracy. In fact, there is a strong pro-democracy movement in Iran to one that is now overtly anti-American.
And yes, and thank you for recapping that the way you did, because that's exactly the way it was going. And what keys me is in my mind, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, we don't want them to be our ally.
Well, I don't think Bush wants
them to be
our allies. We
need that strife in that area to be able to accomplish what it is that we want to do.
Yeah, and
that in effect we are. I would propose the alternative theory that we the Bush administration, or the American public by extension, by virtue of not getting rid of this, impeaching this bunch, what it is all about is that they know what they want to do, and they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the consequence of it. There's a need for strife in that area. There's a need for, we don't want them to come around and to be an ally in that regard. We were very happy when the Shah was in power for 37 years. We kept that in there. We fomented that. We vacillated back and forth between them and Iraq with our policies. We gave whichever country we were happy with at the time the weapons of mass destruction that they used on each other and on whoever else. And I'm listening to this last gentleman that was on the phone with you, and I'm really concerned that this is their intent, and they're waiting for the opportunity. They're laying the groundwork for something to happen in October.
I suspect you're right. I really do, Oren. And Abraham Maslow, the founder of humanistic psychology, once said, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And it is really apparent to me that these guys believe that the only tool that can be used for changing the world in any way at all is war, is murder, is death, is, you know, organized, sanctioned, legal murder, also known as war. And that's what they're all about.
And you know what I'm worried about? That when they get their rapture, that these idiots are going to be standing there with the rest of us wondering, okay, now we're in this mess. What are we going to do with this? Because nobody got to heaven like you thought you were going to go. You just made a mess of everything, and now we've got this nuclear Armageddon on our hands.
Yeah, which is the situation that we have in Iraq right now. Oren, thanks a lot for the call. Yes, sir. We dropped. I'm sorry, Oren, you pushed the wrong button too fast. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, we have about half a minute left. What's up?
It will only take a half minute. Thanks for taking my call. I have some unsolicited advice for the president, vice president, and his followers, if I may. Remember, when the peacock struts his stuff, he shows his backside to half the world.
Oh, man.
And not only that. I say that, and I like him personally. I always have. But
who's the him you're talking about?
We need new leadership with fresh eyes.
Yeah, yeah. I don't disagree with you at all.
And I hope this doesn't come back to haunt me. I believe Senator Obama will be the vice presidential nominee.
Yeah, well, good chance of it. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. You're welcome. Good to hear from you. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Bernie Sanders, although he does have a vote scheduled tomorrow. We'll see how that shakes out. And conservative Neil McCluskey, he opposes a new bill to help sending kids to college. I'll be asking, doesn't democracy require an educated populace? I mean, doesn't it work better that way? And I'll be broadcasting live from WTKG in Grand Rapids, Michigan tomorrow. So have a great afternoon, great evening, and remember, my friends, always, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.